moment. I totally forgot to do that, so the handout's being printed and will be coming. To me, it was a real blessing to have a bit of a window into a different musical heritage. Thank you for that, Lloyd. And it's kind of fascinating to me that regardless of what musical heritage or culture we follow, why the goal, the intent is the same, to lift our souls to God and also to bring him praise and worship. With us here in this assembly is a whole other musical heritage, and that is the Russian folk. And I've enjoyed being around that. I've actually been a little bit jealous of them in that they get the window in the Mennonite heritage all week long, and we don't get any window into your musical heritage all week long. But anyway, be that as it may, we're here to serve our God together. All right, now, the seven laws of teaching. This is going to become basically a book report. Throughout this conference, you've been hearing about books that teachers are drawing from and teachers are benefiting from. This is one that has, for quite a number of years, been somewhat in the shadows, or at least collecting dust on the shelf, if it's been on our shelves. And I don't know, it seems to me that it's gotten new attention in the last 2 decades or so. Now, of course, I don't have that broad of a perspective to say for sure how all this works and how all it's been. But this is a book that can be recommended without reservation. As you've seen, the book that's been waved around here some, The First Days of School, that's a very, very good book. But as Brother Verlin admonished earlier, the book is not biblical in its content entirely, and we can end up making well-educated people, but not really helping them on a moral plane whatsoever. And so that book needs to come with a caution. Unlike this book does not really come with a caution. I'd like to begin by telling you a little bit the story of the book. And then we're going to, break out into a different section where various ones of you will be giving a brief overview of each of the seven laws. So the seven laws of teaching is a classic. And by classic, I'm not exactly sure what that means either, I suppose, but it means it's somewhat traditional, it's enduring, it serves as a standard of excellence. Because of its recognized value. You've heard of classic literary works. They endure. They just stay around. They pass the time test. This book is like that. It was originally published in 1884, which is a little while ago. But then something major happened to it in 1917. There were two professors in the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois was actually a university which John Milton Gregory, the author, helped to found. He's actually buried there at that university, if I remember correctly. No, yes, it says that. He's buried on the university campus. In 1917, it was sanitized. Now, what we mean by sanitized is these two professors were part of the acculturalization that was going on in their time, and they felt that the book just had too much scripture in it. And so they went and they pulled all scriptural references out. Sanitized it. Okay. When I first was introduced to this book, I did not know that it had been sanitized and I was using the sanitized version. Because it was only in 2004 that Veritas Press reprinted it in its original form. Its original manuscripts were rediscovered and reprinted. There's a school there in Moscow, Idaho, called the Logos School, I believe, where they use this book as a course book for, I think, it's a 7-week teacher training event. And I guess they jolly well get this thing pretty much sliced and diced and gone over and examined in 7 weeks. But they had adopted this as their part of their training and also for evaluation purposes for 20 years. They're a Christian organization. For 20 years, the Logos School was using the sanitized version. And then somebody said, did you know that what you're using here is not the original? And they were like, oh, really? Tell us more. I said, well, all the scripture has been taken out. Baker House, do not go out and buy this book from Baker House, because Baker House, even though it's a religious publisher, does not print the unabridged version. They print the sanitized version, right? So what you want to get is the Veritas Press version. CLE does sell the Veritas Press version, and just this summer I learned that there is another publisher printing the unabridged version. Logo School described them discovering this unabridged version. They described it as an embarrassment, as a humiliation, and as a thrill. They said, here they didn't realize, and I quote, they were encouraging the drinking of skim milk without ever knowing what whole milk was like. Right. So we're giving you the whole milk. Now, one of the problems with the whole milk, I say problems, one of the things that you're going to encounter, probably one of the reasons this book is not more popular than it is the language is Old English, sort of, kind of. It doesn't read easily to our language skills, just our many of us are not quite up to it. It's not at all impossible, but many of us have this book and intend to really study it, and we get it out some evening, and then we just sort of have a flat tire. And a lot of it has to do because of the language, the style that's used. I first was introduced to it in the 1990s. I was at a workshop similar to this where we had a series of five classes throughout the week, and I found it helpful. I found it kind of encouraging. I also found it just a little bit intimidating. Laws? I mean, come on, laws? Really? That seemed to me to be a bit inhibiting. We'll talk more on that later. And then later, this institute asked if I would conduct a series of three or four workshops, which I did, and then they did it again a few years later. And then CLE, in their teacher training, or their teacher, they facilitate teacher training. It's not specific to CLE, but especially among the Russian Mennonites in Canada. The Russian Mennonites there are somewhat closed to outside influence, and so they keep on taking the same CLE-facilitated teacher training year after year after year after year after year. Same thing, filling in the same answers, taking the same quizzes and tests. And not only them, but them especially, it was deemed necessary to have a second track that can be studied. And so CLE asked me to write that track for track two using this as the course book. And so I got into the book again. And, you know, every time I study this book, since that I've had various conference calls, some with high school students as part of teacher development, some with, I think, maybe some of you here. Did we study Peter? Okay, and I'm not sure if there's anyone else here, but we had conference calls where we call in and just try to encourage each other in the study of this book. It's very simple in its practicality once you unpackage it. It is not high-hanging fruit. It's rather low-hanging fruit, and it is very, very basic in its instruction of teaching. Now, the premise of the book is simply that there are overarching laws that govern all worthwhile endeavor. So, in other words, if you're going to be a skilled seamstress, there will be some laws that are going to determine the success in your endeavor. I don't know what they'd be because I'm not skilled in that kind of thing, but I suppose there'd be the law of the fabric, maybe the law of fasteners, such as zippers and buttons, the law of the fit. I'm not sure, but you kind of get the idea. That's where we're going with this. Or in grass seed production, which this valley is full of, I suppose that there's laws that govern that as well. And if you follow those laws, and if you relate well to those laws that are just kind of fixed and established, well, then you experience success in grass seed farming. Same with teaching. That approach is called the absolutist approach. In other words, teaching is not something that's nebulous and you kind of hit or miss and we had success. Boy, I wonder how we could repeat that. Well, you can't really because you can't study it. No, that's not the approach. That's not the premise of this book. That's not the premise of law. Law means that it can be studied. It can be reduced to some sort of, here's the set of law that governs it. And these seven laws, I believe, produce or present seven comprehensive axioms that if we understand them, we will be both more efficient and more effective as teachers. That really is the way it is. And when I first studied it, I just started teaching, and its effectiveness, I think a lot of it went over me because it was like, yeah, kind of like the response was, well, duh, that's so simple. I mean, who's going to argue with that? But the longer I taught, the more that I realized that in studying the simple law and letting that simplicity become part of my operating platform, why I was more successful, I believe, in my teaching. Observation and study of these laws, point B, creates skill in the work. Skill can be based on various things. Skill can be based on enthusiasm, or it can be based on, skill-based enthusiasm is better than emotional-based enthusiasm. That's what I mean to be saying. Yeah, it's there on your paper. Enthusiasm, yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Enthusiasm can be based in skill, or it can be based in emotion, and both have their place, I suppose. But skill-based enthusiasm is what we're aiming for and what these laws help us to achieve. The seven laws of teaching are enabling, not restrictive. All right, they're enlivening, they're enriching. So take your teaching to a new level by studying the law. Gregory has quite a section in the first chapter of this book on the fact that law is enabling. And as I've been saying about grass seed, seamstresses, whatever. Once we understand that law and can apply the law, then we experience success. A few words yet about the author. He was born in 1822. He was named after the blind poet, John Milton, who wrote the poems Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. He also wrote the poem On Blindness, which perhaps you studied if you had the literature books by CLE. John Milton Gregory began teaching school when he was 17 years old. So courage, if you feel young. When he was 30, he became superintendent of a school in Detroit. And later he founded the Michigan Journal of Education. That's when he was 32, in 1854. And then he was elected to the state superintendency of the public schools in Michigan, now 36 years old. But he wanted more teaching and less administration. He said, I'm a teacher. I'm not an administrator. And so he went back into teaching in the Kalamazoo, Michigan College as a 41-year-old. But evidently he had some administrative ability because he started the Illinois State University in 1867 as a 45-year-old. And he worked there for an additional 13 years. And then he sort of went into retirement from teaching and at that point served on many educational boards, wrote several books, including this one in 1884, died in 1898 at 76 years old, is buried in the University of Illinois because he said that is the place where he considered the greatest service of his life to be. All right, now we're going to get into the seven laws proper. And some of you are prepared to give a brief overview of these laws. And I think that if you flip the paper over, you should be able to fill in the blanks by listening to them. I would like to say to those of you who are coming here to give this presentation, some of you have not yet been teachers in a classroom, and I'm here to clap for you because I think you're being the bravest. It's not that those of us who taught for a while aren't maybe frightened by being on front of a group, but we've somehow got used to it. And I know that if you mess up, I'll just say this. If you mess up or feel like you messed up, you're in very kind company. Every one of us here is just willing to clap for you. I think we'll refrain from doing a lot of that. But we are behind you. All right, so with that in mind, let's begin. You do get to take this book home for your kind service. I kind of feel a little bit strange here. I feel like this is some sort of illegal subcontract. I was just really happy to see you all studying, those of you who are prepared to do this. But yet, I am very, very pleased that you put yourself into this to do it. All right, so Law 1. We're ready.
The law of the teacher. The teacher must know that which he would teach. That seems simple enough, that we have to know something in order to teach it. How can we know? How can something come out of nothing? That's what the Big Bang Theory is. The world, they say, came out of nothing. We have to have a knowledge of our subjects before and talking about it before we present it to our students. The best way we are going to inspire and teach our students is if we have a good knowledge of our subject and then be excited to share that knowledge with our students. How would you feel if our teachers got up here and fumbled around and didn't really care and you could tell they didn't want to be here? I don't think any of us would feel that they wanted to be here, and we would probably feel disappointed in that. We have to make sure as teachers that we start a day prepared for classes and anything that might come up. And the only way that's going to happen is if we study and gain a good knowledge of our subjects. A teacher's ready and evident knowledge helps to give a student confidence in our teacher and in what they're learning. Matthew 15:14 says, "And if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch." So that goes to show that if the teacher doesn't know what they're teaching, the student won't either, and therefore won't learn. So therefore, let us teachers get to know what we're teaching, be excited about what we're teaching, and then share our knowledge with the students. And again, the law is the teacher must know that which he should teach. Thank you.
That was Deanna. Everybody together, thank you, Deanna. Thank you.
Cheyenne,
please, little two.
Okay. So I'll readily admit that I'm kind of nervous to be up here. I'm not really a public speaker. One of the other teachers told me beforehand, just act with confidence. What he failed to realize is that I am as horrible at acting as I am at public speaking. So I will try to be myself. I had the second law, the law of the learner. The learner must attend with interest to the fact or truth to be learned. I think interest here is the key word. Without interest, you will not be able to keep their attention. They will not have their heart in the subject that they're learning. I remember for me as a student, there was nothing more that I enjoyed than when I fully grasped the concept and it really hit me in that part of my heart, that there was just something that clicked with me. And I would go home studying the rocks that I found on the way home or decomposing a flower, pulling apart, studying it as I went home. There was something that interested me. When it came to math, and then when math combined it with science, again, there was just that click and my heart lit up. This is what we're looking for when it comes to students, is their interest in things. Chapter 3, the second law, it goes into the differences in the attentions and interests of children. It shows that interest varies between students, and therefore we need to learn how to exploit these different interests, find ways to appeal to them, to keep their attention. It also shows that there is a difference between compelled attention and attracted attention. There's a difference between trying to tell your student to pay attention and giving them something that actually interests them and pulls them into what you're saying. This third law also told you, it gave tips to the teacher of how to gain a child's interest, as well as warnings of how you could lose it. These are also things that you have to be careful of, is to not push the child's interest away. If there's something that they're interested in, bring that out, use it, push it farther. This was basically what was in chapter 3. Again, the law was that the learners must attend with interest to the fact or truth to be learned. The vigor of mental action, like that of muscular action, is proportional to the feeling which inspires it. That was from chapter 3.
Everybody together. Thank you, Cheyenne. Law 3. Sweet.
Okay, law 3 is the law of the language. And that law simply states that the language used in teaching must be common to the teacher and to the learner. It's fascinating. The book points out that there's about 100,000 words in the English language. Most adults know about 20,000 words. The average 10-year-old child only knows several hundred. And so if you're teaching third or fourth grade, as I try to practically apply those little bits of information, you might be using words very likely are using words that your child has never heard before. And you know, when you hear a word that you don't know, that you don't understand, it's just like a sound. It has no meaning, right? And the first thing I thought about was what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 14, and I'm going to paraphrase. He said, I would rather speak 5 words with understanding than 10,000 in an unknown tongue. And that's, of course, in the issue of speaking with tongues, but I think it's relative. This chapter, it was challenging to me, and I love words, and it just reminded me that those of us that are teachers, if we do not speak words that our children and our students understand, the message is not going to be communicated very effectively. The book points out several things. It gives several lists in this chapter, lists of rules to apply. I just jotted down a couple of those that I think was very good to remember as a teacher. And that is, we're to study the student's language. We're to listen and to try to understand at what level they are speaking. What do they understand? What words do they use? And so we're to be conscious of that and be thinking and watching for that. One way we do that, and about the only way we can do that, is to get them to talk. A student needs to talk and needs to use language in order for us to understand where they're at. And there's tips and things, and that can be learned and practiced too. And then, of course, we need to use language in the classroom that the students will understand. That the author points out the value of using simple words and short sentences, not using complex, flowery words. The value, the author points out also, of illustrating what you're talking about in order to convey meaning with pictures, with drawings and diagrams is very valuable. And then also that one of the goals of the teacher is to help the student to expand their vocabulary and to invite their interaction. If you do use a new word, the author makes a pretty big point of making sure that you convey the idea of the word. Give a context, give some kind of a clue and something that the student can relate to so they can understand what that new word means. And my my love of words, I sometimes get a little bit carried away, I suppose, but I help score volleyball sometimes, and it gets pretty hot in the Central Valley there in Modesto, and so I've gotten the habit, instead of saying it's hot, I'll just blurt out, the blazing rays of the flaming orb are beating upon my fevered brow. Now, would I have to do that? No, of course I don't, but I love words, and I think sometimes that it's good to challenge our students with maybe a different way of saying things, or use words that they deliberately use words that they don't know, so that there can be some questioning. Let's see. He said the language is the vehicle of thought. It's what carries a thought from the speaker to the listener, from the teacher to the student. It's the instrument of thought. That's kind of an interesting thing. I have played an instrument before, and an instrument is what makes sound. So I was kind of trying to figure out how that fit, and I don't know if I have that figured out yet. But there was a couple of thoughts that he had that I wrote down here. We master truth by expressing it. A student, you know they've got something if they can repeat it back to you, if they can tell you what the concept is. New and unknown words bring a shadow over the understanding. When all of a sudden there's a word that's presented that they don't know, it just kind of like darkens and brings dimness to the whole scene. And so we need to explain and use new words correctly. So the law of the language, again, is the language used in teaching must be common to the teacher and the learner.
Thank you, Lord.
Four. Derek.
Not sure why I had to come after Lloyd, but oh well, that's all right. law number 4, the law of the lesson. And that law states that we need to help students master a lesson built on truth already known by them. We need to build on what's there, build on what they know, using what's known by them to expand on and to grow their knowledge in particular areas. Make sure your students have a firm grip on one concept before expanding on another. Don't try to put more into them without connecting it with what they already know. Had a little illustration here, building blocks. What they know already, and then using what they know from these, using what they know to proceed and build their knowledge and get them higher. If we try to put more into them before connecting with what they know, we end up trying to put a block up here and it just tumbles down and disappears and they never learn it. And don't spend all your time building the same knowledge for fear of stretching them too far. You end up building the same block multiple times. Make sure they have a firm grip on it. So in other words, you don't want a triangle on the bottom of your pyramid or else your squares won't stack very neatly on top of it before they go crashing down. And make sure they have a firm grip on the concept. So find a starting point and work from there. One rather practical illustration that from where I work. When you roll form metal, when you build a panel that looks something, a metal panel that looks something like this, it's five ribs, something, anyway. When you roll form it, you have your dies, the forming dies, and they're 18 inches apart. And you always start in the middle of the panel, because if you try to start with these outside ribs, and you form those first, all of a sudden you get to the middle, and you're trying to pull those outside ribs in. So, you want to start in the middle, and you want to make sure that rib is firmly established before you move on to the next rib, or you will find yourself in trouble by the time you get to the end of the panel, and the panel will be out of proportion, stretched, and that is similar to what it'll be for a student if we don't get everything in place in the order it needs to be. And so that is the law of the lesson.
Thank you, Derek.
Law number five is the law of the learning of the teaching process. It says this to excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he can learn himself. I think this law, in a nutshell, would be to realize that learning is something that happens inside the student. It is not something that the teacher can do for the student. And so he must be careful that he doesn't do too much. And yet, at the same time, he's responsible to supply all the equipment for the student to learn. Or you can think of it like this. I can't take facts from my brain and find that USB and plug it into your brain, download the same information. You need to find that, the student needs to find that himself. And how can we create that curiosity, that desire to learn? How can we give him just enough but not too much? I think it can be illustrated very well with the unicycle. I got a unicycle for my students 1 year, and it was not long at all, and they knew how to ride quite well. Now, you're going to have to excuse my riding expertise because I am really out of practice. But do you understand that all I can do is model riding the unicycle? All I can do is ride the unicycle. It's impossible for me to download the balance onto a thumb drive, stick it into them, and put them on the unicycle. It's not going to work. The only way they're ever going to learn the unicycle is to want to ride the unicycle themselves and to put forth the effort and the diligence it takes. Now, I need to supply the unicycle. I need to actually ride it once in a while, and then I need to give it to them. And that is the law of the teaching process, to realize that ultimately the student is responsible and somehow make him do it. You can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make him drink. Another illustration is, a way you can do this is use questions to try to create curiosity. It doesn't apply exactly well, but the story is told of a Jewish girl who went to her father and said, I would like to study the Talmud. And her father said, well, you're not smart enough yet. And she said, well, really, I just might be. He said, I'm going to give you a question. Two men fell down a chimney, and one man's face was dirty, and one man's face was clean. And which man do you think went and washed his face? Well, the little girl started thinking, and she said, well, of course it was the one with a clean face, because he saw the one with a dirty face and went and washed his face. And her father said, sorry, you're wrong. Your response should be, how can two men fall down one chimney and one's face be clean and one's face be dirty? You see, there's a question behind the question. And if you can create the students, make the students start to ask those questions, that's when the learning happens. There's more to this than just the appearance. Now, the end of this law says something about tell him nothing that he can learn himself, and that is by not giving your students too much information. Perhaps they're asking all the questions and you're giving all the answers. A very good friend of mine was teaching school this last year, and the school had an issue of sucking all the information out of the teachers. And one day she wrote the assignment on the board and she said, now, today I'm just giving you one question. I'm just going to answer one question. It didn't go more than 30 seconds, and one of the boys said, what is the assignment? And she said, it's on the board. He knew. He blew it right there. Finally, the law of the teaching is to excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he can learn himself.
Thank you, Kyle. Theron does law six.
The law of the learning process, this is very similar to the law of the teaching process or whatever the last one was. The learner must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired. It says in this book, lost my page. The work of education is the work of the pupil and not of the teacher. What a surprise. But it is very important to remember we teachers sometimes like to do the work for our students. And there are five basic steps. Well, before we get to the five basic steps, I wonder why we ask questions. The story is told of two boys who were talking about their teacher, and one says, Mr. Smith asked so many questions. He asked questions all day. And the other boy says, yeah, I don't think he knows the answers himself. That's why he asks the questions. Is that why we ask questions to our students? Is because we don't know the answers? Obviously not. Why do we have them write answers in their book? The point is to get them to reproduce in their own head, in their own language, the lesson. And once they have done that, they are already to step four of the learning process. The first step is basically word-for-word memorization of the lesson. If we have, suppose we're teaching about direct objects, the student reads a lesson in his book. He comes to the class table, we ask him, Sam, what is a direct object? He says, a direct object is a word that receives the action of a noun. He learned his lesson? He has completed step one. He has memorized the words of the lesson, but he still doesn't know what a direct object is, really. The second step in the learning process is adding to the thought of the lesson. This might be when he can make up a sentence of his own. The dog bit the cat. That is a sentence with a direct object. He's achieved step two. I might be getting these steps mixed up. But he can add to the thought of the lesson. Step three is when the child can, or the learner can restate in his own words the lesson or the truth to be learned. So suppose at the end of the class you say, okay, Sam, what is a direct object? And he says, okay, so a direct object is like when the dog bites the cat, then the cat is a direct object. That's not what the English book told him. He's restating that in his own words. He's up to level three by now of the learning process. Then step four in the learning process is when the child starts to seek evidence for it. He starts to do his own research. He wants to prove it to himself. He wants to learn more about this learning process. And I think once we have
Okay, why does the teacher ask questions? Does not the teacher ask questions to inspire the student to ask questions? If we haven't, if the student is not inspired to ask his own questions and seek his own information about this subject, then we haven't, we have not yet taught the lesson completely enough. A child asks questions because he wants to know. A four-year-old child wants to know everything, and so he asks lots and lots of questions. And a teacher doesn't ask questions because he wants to know, but because he wants to inspire the child to want to know. Okay, now the fifth step of this process is when the child can apply it to himself. The fifth step in learning a direct object is when you're on the playground and you try to catch a ball and it misses and hits your head and the child cries, "I am a direct object!" He has applied it to his own life. That is the fifth step. I love this literature book, as many of you do, I assume. Somebody did a great job in putting it together. But I didn't always enjoy it. And my enjoyment started when, in ninth grade, when I had a teacher who loved this book. And he inspired me to not just read the words. See, when I was in ninth grade, I could read a poem as like this one. Still as of old, men by themselves are priced. For 30 pieces, Judas sold himself, not Christ. And that was just words. I could memorize that very quickly, and I could know that poem. And yet my teacher, Brother Evan, inspired me to go beyond that. That was step one. Step two might be asking deeper questions. And step three, when the literature book asks a thought question, I have to sit there at my desk and scrunch my eyes and try to restate this deep thought in my own words. Now I'm getting to step three of understanding this lesson, understanding this poem. And step four may be step four is when you start to see how it fits into the big picture. You see the symbolism in it and as of how it all works. Sorry. Step five. I may never attain to step five when I'm in school, when I'm in ninth grade. But years later, I hope, when I come to a decision, when I'm tempted to sell myself for 30 pieces, I remember this poem, and I choose not to sell myself for 30 pieces, and that is when the learning process is finally complete in my heart. The law of the learning process, the learner must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired.
Thank you, Derek. And Law 7.
So if the student has already learned, the teacher's figured out how to teach, the student is learning, why do we need another law yet? But the seventh law is very important. It's the law of review. The completion, test, and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews. What's the purpose of review? Well, basically three things. You want to perfect what they have learned. If you're teaching about adjectives, by the end of the class, they hopefully have a pretty good idea of what an adjective is. When you come to class the next day, will they still know what an adjective is? Well, hopefully they kind of have at least a foggy remembrance. But after the first day, the second, the third day, you're going to keep coming back to that thing of adjectives. And you might put a sentence on the board and say, where's the adjective? You might say, go to the board and diagram this sentence, and you'll purposely put an adjective in there to see whether they remember that. It's review. It's making sure it's perfecting what you're teaching. Second thing, and it kind of overlaps here, but you want to make sure it sticks, that they actually have it. You might walk into history class and call them to class and say, okay, when did the Civil War end? Just random question. You're seeing if it's sticking up here, if they actually have that. Maybe you're trying to make sure they're ready for a history test. You give them a blank map. Maybe you draw it on the board, and you say, all right, which country is this? We're on their map. Label the countries. It's review. You're trying to make sure that it's up here. And thirdly, you also, in reviewing, want to help make it useful, make it practical for them. Maybe you've been teaching math concepts, and so you walk in to class and you say, okay, yesterday we learned about this, and you give them a real-life problem, and maybe it will help it click, and they go, oh, I know why we're learning that now. I tried to do that this past year. We didn't have a ball diamond. We needed to set it up. So I took them out, and we used the Pythagorean formula, and we calculated the dimensions of the ball diamond, how far it should be across the corner, and then we did that in the classroom. Then we walked out, and we stretched the tape measure, and we put in stakes, and we, you know, real-life situation, try to apply it. It will help it stick. So those are the three basic things of review. Now, review can be done a lot of ways. Review is repetition, especially younger grades. It's that line upon line, precept upon precept, saying those math facts over and over. But it's more than repetition. It's going back, finding tidbits. How often do you read through a book, through the Bible, a verse, and something new jumps out at you? You thought you knew it, everything that was there, and suddenly, bam, something new. Well, it's part of review. You're actually finding new things as you review. Ask questions. That's already been talked about in actually teaching. Ask questions. Jesus was a master of that. They'd ask him a question. What would he do? He'd turn it back. He'd ask them a question. Give quizzes. Involve the senses. We've heard about that here this week. Involve as many of the senses. Give them quizzes. It's seeing if it's up here. We're not simply trying to put isolated facts in data banks. We're trying to prepare children for life. Variety and review helps to connect the dots in their minds and in their lives. So, use the law of review to your advantage. Completion tests and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you to each one of you. You have exceeded my expectations, and you give me hope about the coming school year. Very briefly, I think some of the wording might not have matched up as good as it should have to fill in blanks, but Law 5, the words I intended there are teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind. Arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or master the desired art. And then Law 6, learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth or working into habit a new art or skill. Are there any other blanks that aren't very clear? The test or proof of learning, Law 7, when you can write 3-4 times for the review. The test or proof of teaching done. And there's other words that would be aligned with the thought of the law. Oh, then re. Okay. So one of the reasons this book stands the test of time is because we learn and teach the same way that we learn and have learned and have taught. And will learn and will teach. Right. You'll have to study it more for yourself. Time is up. Thank you so very much. I would say this yet. The difference between Law 1 and 2 and 5 and 6, they parallel each other closely. Law 1 and 2 tell what the teacher or learner is. Law 5 and 6 tell what the teacher and learner do. That's the main difference. Thank you so much. You're excused.